Jose Antonio Primo de Rivera. He was born in 1903 and murdered on November 20th, 1936 by a leftist government firing squad. Jose Antonio was the founder and creator of the Falange, which was a Spanish fascist organization during the 1930s. Now, the Falange had a short run, contrary to popular belief. The Falange existed from around 1933 to 1936. In order to understand how Jose Antonio came about and who he was, it is best to understand his father. So that's where we'll start this story. We'll start it with the Primo de Rivera dictatorship from 1923 to 1930. The two books I'll be quoting from in this video are Fascism in Spain by Stanley G. Payne and The Spanish Answer, passages from the spoken and written messages of Jose Antonio Primo de Rivera. So we start with the de Rivera dictatorship. During 1922 to 1923, Spanish affairs seemed stalemated. Frustrated, King Alfonso XIII began to embrace the concept of military government. Major sectors of the military also demanded changes, or at least a stronger government. Yet, the internal division and lack of leadership were so great that no commander stepped forward to take the lead. The pronunciamiento that many had begun to talk about. Now, this pronunciamiento is translates to pronouncement or announcement or declaration. It's a form of military rebellion. So that's what they're talking about, this military rebellion. The pronunciamiento of 13th September 1923 that overthrew the constitutional government thus depended on the personal initiative of Miguel Primo de Rivera. This is Jose Antonio's father. Captain General of Barcelona, descended from a illustrious military family with roots in the region of Jerez de la Frontera, Primo de Rivera was the product of a military career that had spanned more than three decades. Tall and heavy-set, but rather distinguished-looking, and a frank military man of good nature and authoritarian ideas, he had served with distinction and unusual courage in Cuba, Morocco, and the Philippines. Strongly influenced by the Regenesist spirit, he became convinced that only a temporary military government could achieve unity, solve problems, and institute necessary reforms. The revolution succeeded above all because the liberal government did almost nothing to defend itself. The issue was finally decided 2 days later by the crown, as Alfonso XIII, without invoking constitutional limits or procedures, transferred power to what would become the first direct military dictatorship in Spanish history. So this is pretty much in the last stages of kingship. I mean, we saw how kings disappeared. First, they had to essentially give a little power to maintain their power, and they started allowing these parliaments to form and these, you know, pseudo-democracies to come about. And then slowly from there, each kingship was phased out. So these were the last stages of the monarchy in Spain. And so while you have your parliament, the king is still the figurehead. And he's separate from the government, as allowing the government to operate and do its things. But he can step in and cause a lot of problems with a lot of support if need be. And in this instance, he was favorable towards this, quote-unquote, military coup, and which it really wasn't. It was just kind of a soft transfer of power. But since he supported it, it was a soft transfer of power and not an actual military coup. Let us go on back to the book now. Primo de Rivera gave no evidence of any explicit theory or plan. In fact, his only professed ideology was constitutional liberalism. He insisted that the Constitution of 1876 remain the law of the land. It is generally agreed that the instruction of the dictatorship was greeted with relief and broad if shallow, support from the public. This was true even among the moderates and many liberals. Ortega Y. Gasset hailed the new government in El Sol as a splendid opportunity to cut the Gideon knot restraining the modernization and regeneration. The Iron Surgeon has arrived. The regular government was replaced by a military dictatorship composed of 8 brigadier generals and 1 admiral. Public order was quickly controlled by martial law, which was maintained for 2 years until 1925. For several years, the dictator himself would be a generally popular figure with many admirers. His bluff, informal manner, and sly sense of humor were appreciated as he appeared frequently in public and made an effort to communicate directly with the citizenry. He was looking favorably to what was going on in Italy too at the time. In a newspaper interview, Miguel had said, "Fascism is a universal phenomenon that ought to conquer all the nations. Fascism is a living gospel." So with that statement, you would expect this military dictator to start to implement this fascist ideology in Spain. But for whatever reason, he didn't. His policy during the dictatorship. The dictatorship featured close association with Catholicism. Religion, in fact, became the main single ideological force invoked to legitimize the new regime, with official support for the church activities and the formation of numerous local citizen committees to ensure orthodoxy and the social and cultural activities. But not every religious politician or religious person was in favor or viewed Miguel as being solely motivated by the church. As one Catholic statement stated, "The church, ignoring all its traditions, placed itself at the service of force against law and justice." So not everyone was happy with it. One of the most progressive aspects of the regime's economic policy was the introduction of a tax reform that, for the first time, tried to shift part of the burden from excesses and property taxes to slightly graduated income taxes. Though the change was comparatively modest, it marked the only reform of any particular significance in that area until the 1980s. Between 1920 and 1930, state expenditures on education more than doubled. School attendance increased by 23%, and outlays of public health tripled. There were major increases in social services, with resultant significant declines in both infant mortality and general death rate. The dictatorship instigated the first significant programs of housing subsidies in Spanish history and also enhanced workers' rights and the scope of workers' insurance. Women over 18 years of age would be allowed to vote for the first time, and the regime utilized all its resources to gain a positive outcome. So in other words, it kind of created a new voter class to lock down the votes, kind of like what the Democrats in America are doing with the illegal immigrants. In regards to any constitutional reforms, Primo opted to convene a new National Assembly that they deliberated on possible constitutional reforms. He was often criticized for trying to copy Italian fascism, a charge though he continually denied. Ironically enough, these are the same accusations that later his son would have to go on and deny too. We go on. The dictatorship began to drift into crisis, due in part to a deteriorating financial situation. Even though 1929 marked the apex of the industrial boom and Spanish exports reached an all-time high, not to be seen again for more than 30 years, easy credit and the entry of more and more foreign capital had encouraged the government to maintain a high rate of exchange for the peseta, which is their money. Rumors that the peseta would be placed on the gold standard only encouraged more money to enter Spain, at least for the time being. Yet, prosperity was also raising imports to unprecedented levels, while the government's heavy expenditures were now placing its budget severely in the red. By the end of 1928, it was clear that there could be no conversion to gold, and the government had to resort to increasingly interventionist measures to try and maintain the peseta's value as more and more money flowed out. During the course of 1929, the peseta lost more than a third of its value on the international market, despite massive efforts at artificial support. Though most of the economy remained prosperous well into the 1930s, suffering little from the first phase of international depression, prices dropped steadily in the stock exchange during the course of 1929. By 1929, the regime had lost the confidence of businessmen and financiers. There was growing rebellion over the dictatorship's interventionalism and statist policies, which were now declared to be holding the economy back. And some Spanish producers even challenged a high tariff policy, demanding lower prices and more support for exports. The most overt opposition during 1929 came from the intelligentsia and the university students. University students became a political factor for the first time, partly because their number had more than doubled under the dictatorship, from fewer than 19,000 in 1922 to more than 42,000 in 1929. Primo de Rivera's eventual downfall, as the Italian organ Critica Fascista rightly pointed out, owed much to the fact that this was essentially a movement of the quinquagesimarians devoid of any meaningful support either on the campuses or among the youth in general. So you can equate this to the modern day Republican Party. Like, most of its supporters are over 50. They haven't done much to win the youth. So same with Miguel Primo de Rivera. Here he is. He's doing all these policies. And their economic troubles were not that bad. Were not that bad. But when you look at, you have leftist professors, and now you have a lot more students. Thanks to your policies, there's a lot more students now. But you're not doing anything to win these students over. You haven't done anything, because he essentially didn't make any big moves in office. And it was actually a joke about, once he was gone, he's like, what, you know, they're like the first dictator where there was no bloodshed. Meaning that might sound like a good thing, but it's not, because it means you made no serious moves that you know, you had to fight for anything to improve the country. They, you know, like it was said, he agreed with the constitution, essentially, that was in place before he even came to power. So they made no effort to win over the youth. And so the leftist professors, they have more youth to work with now, ended up, you know, as they do today in America, converted to youth, to this more leftist and, you know, anti-state ideology and or anti-nation ideology. And this, you know, eventually was one of the reasons towards his downfall. Was most of his support was just old conservative, you know, super religious types. We go on. By 1930, a military conspiracy was underway, possibly encouraged by the crown itself. The dictator had lost the personal popularity of the earlier years and was now 60 years of age, suffering severely from diabetes with greatly diminished energy. All the backing from the army gone, Don Afonso was able to obtain his resignation on the 30th of January, 1930. The dictatorship ended in a complete failure due to its inability to legitimize itself or create any political alternative. His labor minister, Anios, even suggested that the dictatorship had failed because Primo had never fully escaped the mental boundaries of liberalism. He would go on to die in Paris in March 1930. As stated in the book, he died of disease and disappointment. The collapse of the dictatorship brought the downfall of the Spanish monarchy within 15 months. For the crown's recognition of the dictatorship in 1923 had seriously compromised the legitimacy of the reign of Alfonso XIII. Now, Alfonso never officially abdicated the crown. He just left town pretty much after a liberal republic government was elected. So he went off into kind of his own imposed exile. In reaction to this, rightist groups of all shades popped up. Conservatives, monarchists, hardline Catholics, authoritarian types, military types, etc. All kinds. There was much division on the right and many different groups, all sharing some common themes, but differing in some areas as well. Jose was born in 1903 to an upper-class family with a strong military tradition, dating back at least 300 years. He was now the oldest of five siblings, three boys, two girls. His mother died very young through childbirth, and they were pretty much raised by their aunt. As a kid, he wanted to join the military, but his father discouraged this and instead got him into law school, where he would go on to excel at the top of his class and get his law degree. But after he wrapped up law school, he joined a voluntary military unit for a few years. Now, one of these fractured rightist groups, one group called the UMN, nationalist group, a small, insignificant nationalist group. Being a law school graduate, he transitioned easily into the world of politics. He served as a vice secretary general of the UMN, and his life mission seemed to be to vindicate his father's name. Because once again, his father, it was kind of ridiculed. He was kind of seen as a failure and all these things. So this was obviously one of his driving forces, was to redeem not only his father, but their name, period. Now, during the summer of 1933, Jose Antonio and Ruiz de Alda formed a group called the Movimiento Sindicalista Español, the MES. So this is his first party he's forming. Now, about the party, MES, he says, "Before everything and above all ideology, fascism is the resolute will to create a virile, harmonious, and totalitarian state. Our party is the authentically Spanish form of what has become a normal crusade in the great countries to redeem Europe, to redeem the fatherlands of Europe from the spiritual degradation and material ruin in which they have been sunk by the poisonous anti-national left and the cowardly, obtuse, egotistical right." So Jose was showing a little bit of his fascistic side early in his youth with his neither left nor right position. By now, you have a handful of different resistance groups, all, you know, all on the right, a fractured, divided right. They all have their own little newsletters, and they're all competing somewhat with each other, but more so against the liberal ideology. But nonetheless, it's fractured right-wing parties, some of them more Catholic than others, some of them more militaristic than the others, some of them more conservative than the others, and some even more fascist than the others. Out of the different rightist groups, there was about two groups that were, you know, more fascistic, and that was Jose Antonio's UMN and Ramos's, his J-O-N-S, which translates to Boards of the National Syndicalists Offensive. With MES not really going anywhere, basically being stillborn, Jose Antonio looked for different means forward. Embracing an even more fascistic demeanor, Jose Antonio would seek to create a new party. He would deliver a speech in a theater filled with mainly rightists and radical rightist members. In his speech, he would explain his vision of the direction of the new party being created and the future of Spain. From the speech now, he says, "The liberal state came to offer us economic slavery. Therefore, socialism had to be born. And its birth was just. Workers had to defend themselves from that system, which only promised them rights, but made no effort to give them a just life. But socialism, at first a legitimate reaction against liberal slavery, lost its way. First, in the materialist interpretation of life and history. Second, in its sense of a reprisal. Third, in proclaiming the dogma of the class struggle. The patria, which is basically fatherland, homeland, is total unity. This is what our total sense of the patria and the state which must serve it requires. That all the people of Spain, however diverse, be harmonized in an irrevocable unity of destiny. The political parties disappear. No one was ever born a member of a political party, but we are all born as members of a family. We are all residents of a municipality. We intend, if it is sometimes necessary to achieve this through violence, that we not shrink from violence." Dialectics are perfectly good as the first instrument of communication, but no dialectic is admissible other than the dialectic of fists and pistols when justice or the patria is outraged. Our movement would not be understood at all if it were thought to be just a way of thinking. It is not a way of thinking, but a manner of being. We must adopt, before all of life, in every act, a profound, humane, and concrete attitude. This attitude is the spirit of service and of sacrifice, the ascetic and military sense of life. 4 days later, they would come up with a new name for the party, the Falange Espagnole, Spanish Phalanx. So, in 1933, the Falange was officially created. About that, he goes on to say, "We are all born in a family. We all live in a municipality. We all work a trade or profession. But no one is born or lives naturally in a political party. Thus, the new state must recognize the integrity of the family as a social unit, the autonomy of the municipality as a territorial unit, and the syndicate, the guild, the corporation as the authentic base of the organization of the state. For everyone, true freedom, which is only achieved by forming a part of a strong and free nation. For no one, the freedom to protrude, poison, or incite destructive passions, or to undermine the cohesion of the enduring political organization. The bases are authority, hierarchy, and order." In November of 1933, Jose Antonio ran for political office, not as a fascist and not as a member of the Falange, but more so as a rightist nationalist. We go back to the book. Jose Antonio was personally offered a place on the rightist list in both Madrid and Cadiz and accepted the latter. The campaign was marred by several incidents. The worst occurred prior to a speech in San Fernando on 13 November, when a leftist gunman attempted to fire at the speakers, but succeeded only in killing one spectator and wounding four others, one of whom, a female relative of Jose Antonio, was left permanently blind. This may be considered the first of several attempts on Jose Antonio's life, for the accomplice of the killer, later arrested, declared that the action was in protest against the appearance of a fascist candidate. The victory of the right and the center in the Cortes elections of November 1933 facilitated Jose Antonio's fairly easy victory in his own district, where he placed second on the rightist list. The biggest winner was the new Catholic CEDA, C-E-D-A, a Spanish confederation of autonomous right-wing groups, which emerged as the largest single political party in the country. The triumph of the moderate right would prove highly detrimental to the Falange, for it seemed to prove that a more moderate, legalist tactics would suffice to defeat the left in democratic Spain. So with this moderate right wing winning, a lot of these, you know, more fringe rightist groups found it harder to survive, harder to get funding, harder to get support. So what ended up happening was the other fascistic themed group out there, JONS, the one led by Ramos, decided he and Jose Antonio would get together and decide to merge their parties. On 11 February 1934, the National Council of the Juans, representing the nine local Juanista groups then in existence, met in Madrid to consider a merger. The majority of its 15 members voted to pursue possible terms of unification. There was little difficulty in arriving at terms. So the party, the Falange, daily operations would henceforth be run by a triumvirate of Jose Antonio, Ramos, and Ruiz de Alda. At their first unified meeting, shots broke out. As the Falangists left the theater, shots broke out and there was some fighting in the streets. Though one Falangist was killed, the leaders considered the meeting a successful baptism of fire for the newly unified movement. Before we go on, let's get into a little bit of who these other members of the triumvirate are, Ramos and Ruiz de Alda. First, Romero Ramos. Romero Ledzma Ramos was born in a small town in the Zamora province in 1905, son of a school teacher who was also the son of a school teacher. So two generations of school teacher there. Unable to afford an elite higher education, he completed secondary school by examination in Salamanca at the age of 16. For several years, he moved around to different cities and served a brief period in a mandatory military service in the army. He had written a few philosophical novels in his early 20s and apparently was very well read. During the later 1920s, Ledesma may have been the best read young intellectual in Madrid. Square, tense, and abstract, this green-eyed young intellectual of medium height and reasonably attractive, though not conventionally handsome, appearance seems to have had little or no private life and no known sex life, which was the opposite of Jose Antonio. He was more known as like a playboy. So you kind of have this shut-in intellectual here, as opposed to this this outgoing charismatic figure in Jose Antonio. Mornings were devoted to his work as a civil employee, while afternoons and evenings and weekends were given over to university classes and to the incessant reading and writing. Essentially, his cause was his mistress, it's looking like. Philosophy was his passion. He seemed to especially like the German philosophers. By 1930, he was focusing on Heideggerian angst. Anguish and the threat of nothingness could be overcome by will and achievement. By an action that would increasingly become direct action. It was around 1930 where Ramos dropped his more traditional beliefs of reviving the past of Spain and began to believe in something of a popular modern revolution of unity, authority, and central leadership, with a revolutionary economic program to reintegrate the masses and the readiness to affirm willpower, violence, and the conquest of a new place in the world. What Spain needed was something like fascism. He made the decision to abandon scholarship and philosophy for political activism and to save Spain. So that's Ramos, seemingly very intelligent and passionate guy who dedicated his life to his political ideology. And now we have Julio Ruiz de Alda, the next member of the triumvirate. He was a former military artillery officer and aviation hero, co-pilot of the famous transatlantic flight led by Ramon Franco from Spain to Argentina in 1926. For the Spanish-speaking world, this exploit was the South Atlantic equivalent of Charles Lindbergh's epic journey. So this guy's kind of comes off as a Goering figure, you know, an aviation hero before coming into the party and kind of giving the party some credibility. A hardy military man, he was a strong nationalist who was repelled by the subsequent leftist radicalism. By the time the Republic was founded, he had declared that Spain needed a totalitarian system. In 1931, he had briefly joined Juan's, but was not an active member. He later got in touch with Jose Antonio. He and Jose Antonio complemented each other and got along well together. Ruiz de Alda was no intellectual and had limited ability for public speaking, but was down to earth and had a certain amount of organizational ability. He could also sometimes reduce Jose Antonio's grandiloquent rhetoric to more practical terms. The two agreed that Spanish fascism must be clearly distinct from the right and make a strong appeal to the workers. During the summer of 1933, Jose Antonio and Ruiz de Alda, together with a handful of collaborators, founded an entity that they called the Movimiento Sindicalista Español, the MES. So he was with Jose Antonio with the creation of the MES and with the creation of the Falange. So they were partners together for quite a while. Now that we have the creation of the Falange and we explained a little bit about the triumvirate, let's get into the 26 points. Now, these were introduced maybe a year after the party was formed, but we'll get into it now before we continue on with the story so we can understand where the Falange was coming from, what they wanted, what they idealized for their society and their fellow citizen. Okay, so let's get started. The first block deals with nation, unity, and empire. Point one, we believe in the supreme reality of Spain. The strengthening, elevating, and magnifying of this reality is the urgent collective goal of all Spaniards. Individual, group, and class interests must inexorably give way in order to achieve this goal. The first point is right to the point. This we have a belief about being unified, working together for a greater goal. Number two, Spain has a single destiny in the world. Every conspiracy against this common unity is repulsive. Any kind of separation is a crime which we shall not pardon. The existing constitution, to the degree that it encourages disintegration, weakens this common destiny of Spain. Therefore, we demand its annulment in a thundering voice. So, not making the mistake his father made by not going in there and scrapping their constitution and building a society truly capable of, you know, obtaining these great goals and these great visions. Point number three, we have the determination to build an empire. We affirm that Spain's historic fulfillment lies in empire. We claim for Spain a preeminent position in Europe. We can tolerate neither international isolation nor foreign interference. As regards the countries of Hispanic America, we favor the unification of their culture, economic interests, and power. Spain will continue to act as a spiritual axis of the Hispanic world, as a sign of preeminence in worldwide enterprises. So a little bit like Hitler dreamed about unifying the Nordic countries, Jose Antonio here is speaking about unifying all the Latin-speaking countries. Four, our armed forces on land, sea, and in the air must be kept trained and sufficiently large to assure to Spain at all times its complete independence and the status in the world that befits it. We shall bestow upon our armed forces of land, sea, and air the dignity they merit. And we shall cause their military conception of life to infuse every aspect of Spanish life. 5. Spain shall once more seek her glory and her wealth on the sea lanes. Spain must aspire to become a great maritime power for reasons of both defense and commerce. We demand for the fatherland equal status with others in maritime power and aerial routes. All right, the next block of points will be on state, individual, and liberty. Number six, our state will be a totalitarian instrument to defend the integrity of the fatherland. All Spaniards will participate in this through their various family, municipality, and syndical roles. There shall be no participation in it by political parties. We shall implacably abolish the system of political parties and their consequences. Inorganic suffrage, representation of clashing groups, and a parliament of the type that is all too well known. Number seven, human dignity, integrity, and freedom are eternal, intangible values. But one is not really free unless he is a part of a strong and free nation. As no one will be permitted to use his freedom against the nation, which is the bulwark of the fatherland's freedom. Rigorous discipline will prevent any attempt to envenom and disunite the Spanish people or to incite them against the destiny of the fatherland. Number eight, the nationalist syndicalist state will permit all kinds of private initiative that are compatible with the collective interest. True fascist principle there. And it will also protect and encourage the profitable ones. So, free market with regulation, free market with oversight, the most logical way. All right, the next block of points on economy, labor, and class struggle. Number nine, our conception of Spain in the economic realm is that of a gigantic syndicate of producers. We shall organize Spanish society corporatively through a system of vertical syndicates for the various fields of production, all working towards national economic unity. 10. We repudiate the capitalist system, which shows no understanding of the needs of people, dehumanizes private property and causes workers to be lumped together in a shapeless, miserable mass of people who are filled with desperation. Our spiritual and national conception of life also repudiates Marxism. We shall redirect the impetuousness of those working class who today are led astray by Marxism. We shall seek to bring them into a direct participation in fulfilling the great task of the national state. Number 11, the national syndicalist state will not cruelly stand apart from man's economic struggles, nor watch impassively while the strongest class dominates the weakest. Our regime will eliminate the very roots of class struggle, because all who work together in production shall compromise one single organic entity. We reject, and we shall prevent at all costs, selfish interest from abusing others. And we shall halt anarchy in the field of labor relations. Number 12, the first duty of wealth and of our state shall so affirm is to better the conditions of the people. It is intolerable that the enormous masses of people should live wretchedly while a small number enjoys all kinds of luxuries. 13, the state will recognize private property as a legitimate means of achieving individual family and social goals, and will protect against the abuses of large-scale finance capital speculators and moneylenders. So that is the fascist stance on private property, and you see that in most fascistic parties. And the Marxists, you know, typically say this is for the capitalists, private property is for the capitalists, means the big companies can buy up all these lands. Well, no, that's exactly why they made it and had to explain it into a point. When we say private property, we mean it as the individual, as the family owning land that they can pass on to their children if need be, etc. Land that will exist in a family's name. It is not talking about corporations buying up all the land they can to put factories on it. There's regulation with that. They don't understand corporatism, and they don't understand syndicalism if they're constantly promoting fascism is essentially capitalism because of the private property issue. It's just simply incorrect. 14. We shall support the trend towards nationalism of banking services and through a system of corporations, the great public utilities. 15. All Spaniards have the right to work. Public agencies must of necessity provide support for those who find themselves in desperate straits. As we proceed towards a totally new structure, we shall maintain and strengthen all the advantages that existing social legislation gives to workers. 16. Unless they are disabled, all Spaniards have the duty to work. The national syndicalist state will not give the slightest consideration to those who fail to perform some useful function and who try to live as drones at the expense of the labor of the majority of people. So there's two people that's getting a big FU right there, and these two people pretty much sway the direction of the country of America today. And that is who? The highest rung on the ladder and the lowest rung on the ladder. What they're saying with that is, if you're some speculating Wall Street type, you're done. You're not producing anything for the country. You're not contributing to the country with your speculation. And same thing if you're a welfare parasite. If you're someone that just thinks you can get by with living on welfare, you're not going to live in this society. You're not going to exist. So at both ends, the big F you, speculators, get the hell out of here. Welfare parasites, get the hell out of here. The next section focuses on land. 17. We must, at all costs, raise the standard of living in the countryside, which is Spain's permanent source of food. To this end, we demand agreement that will bring the accumulation, without any further delay, of economic and social reforms of the agricultural sector. 18. Our program of economic reforms will enrich agricultural production by means of the following: by assuring a minimum remuneration to all agricultural producers, by demanding that there be restored to the countryside, in order to provide it with adequate endowment, a portion of that which the rural population is paying to the cities for intellectual and commercial services. By organizing a truly national system of agricultural credit, which will lend money to farmers at low interest against the guarantee of their property and crops, and redeem them from usury and local tyrants. By spreading education with respect to better methods of farming and sheep raising. By ordering the rational utilization of land in accordance with their suitability and with marketing possibilities. By adjusting tariff policy in such a way to protect the agriculture and livestock industry. By accelerating reclamation projects, by rationalizing the units of cultivation so as to eliminate wasted, uneconomic, minuscule plots. 19. Our program of social reform in the field of agriculture will be achieved by redistributing arable land in such a way as to revive family farms and to give energetic encouragement to the syndicalization of farm laborers, by redeeming from misery those masses of people who presently are barely eking out a living on sterile land, and by transferring such people to new arable lands. 20. We shall undertake a relentless campaign of reforestation and livestock breeding, and we shall punish severely those who resist it. We shall support the compulsory temporary mobilization of the Spanish youth for this historic goal of rebuilding the national commonwealth, putting youth to work in beautification projects and terraforming, which is a great idea, especially for city youth. Get them a little acclimated with nature and the land around them and why it's important and how beautiful it is and how connected we are to it. Whether we live in a big city or not. 21. The state may expropriate without indemnity lands of those owners who either acquired them or exploited them illegally. 22. It will be the primary goal of the national syndicalist state to rebuild the communal patrimonies of the town. And the next block, national education and religion. 23. It shall be the essential mission of the state to attain by means of rigorous disciplining of education a strong, unified national spirit, and to instill in the souls of future generations a sense of rejoicing and pride in the fatherland. All men shall receive pre-military training to prepare them for the honor of being enlisted in the National and Popular Army of Spain. So also kind of a common theme we see with the land beautification and terraforming, putting a youth to that, like maybe they do a year or 6 months of that, and then mandatory minimal military training for everyone, and so that people that don't even go into the military or choose not to have some training and have some understanding of it, because, you know, in case need be, if they ever need to be called up in a total war situation, they won't be completely wet behind the ears as far as military training goes. And also, it's good training for the self, physical, mental, discipline. 24. Cultural life shall be organized so that no talent will be undeveloped because of insufficient economic means. All who merit it shall be assured ready access to higher education. Once again, another fascistic theme that you can see is pretty much universal amongst fascist parties is nationalized education. Merit decides, not money, on the position you should hold and the education you get. 25. Our movement incorporates the Catholic meaning of glorious tradition and especially in Spain, a national reconstruction. The church and the state will coordinate their respective powers so as to permit it no interference or activity that may impair the dignity of the state or the national integrity. Essentially what they're saying is separation of church and state. And the last point, the Falange Espagnole demands as a new order as set forth in the foregoing principles, in the face of the resistance from the present order, it calls for a revolution to implant this new order. Its method of procedure will be direct, bold, and combative. Life signifies the art and science of warfare, and must be lived with a spirit that is purified by service and sacrifice. Okay, now that we got the 26 points out the way, and also who the members of this triumvirate were, get a better understanding what the Falange was about and who was running it. Let's get back to the story at hand here. Now, as with their first meeting, as violence broke out after that, Violence seemed to be a theme that went on all throughout the Falange's early life. And contrary to popular belief, it wasn't the Falange inciting a lot of this violence. It was the left attacking the Falange. And in fact, the topic of violence would be essentially why the triumvirate would separate in the end. The left had already drawn first blood when a Yontista government employee was stabbed to death by a socialist at a socialist meeting. And this had not been a planned kill so much as a crime of political passion. 1 month later, Ruiz de Alda barely escaped being attacked while passing through the town of Tudela. His car was seized and burned by assailants. On 4 December, a Yontista banker was killed, and a third Yontista was killed 26 December. The first fatalities were Yontistas, apparently because they were better known and in some cases more aggressive than the new Falangists. The fact that these first acts of deadly violence by the left took place in smaller towns and cities was an indication of the level of social and political tension building in Spain. The first fatality in Madrid occurred with the sale of the first number of FE. This was the Falangist newsletter. On 7 December 1933, when a student, apparently not a Falangist, but simply an interested reader, was killed buying a copy. And the Falangist university unit, its student unit, was called the SEU, which translates to the Spanish University Union. Political opponents put so much pressure on kiosk dealers that the FE was virtually barred from retail trade, and SEU students had to hawk each number on the streets. Several squads of activists were formed to protect the vendors. And when the fifth number of the FE appeared on 11th January, Jose Antonio and Ruiz de Alda personally joined the escorts to encourage their youngsters. Several major brawls erupted, and later in the day, a 22-year-old student, not a member of the SEU, but apparently a sympathizer, was shot and killed after buying a copy. So this is the second young person murdered from buying a copy of this newsletter. And this is one of the misconceptions of fascism, and one of the contradictions of it, is its opponents will admit it's reactionary, but then they'll try to portray them as the instigator of violence. No, fascist violence is also reactionary. And you're already seeing a good case of it in Spain. You're seeing Yontista members murdered, and university students buying newsletters murdered for buying these newsletters because they might convince them to be fascists. As a sympathizer of the Falange, the university student killed, was treated as the first fallen member of the new party. Falangists attended his funeral and for the first time chanted the ritual Presente, borrowed from the Italian fascism, which would be a permanent feature of ceremonies for the Falangist dead. Now, despite sometimes using the rhetoric like the dialectic of fist and pistols, Jose Antonio did not beat the drums of violence, he often caught criticism for this. He seemed to be fine with fist fighting in the streets and did not seem to be a fan of deadly violence or in deadly force, and he had hoped, maybe somewhat naively, that much deadly force would not be necessary to bring forth a fascist Spain. Sadly, this seems to be one of his greatest misjudgments, as it was not only would this go on, this dispute, especially with Ramos on the topic of violence, would go on to split the triumvirate. It would, essentially later go to cost Jose Antonio his own life by not taking the more aggressive, violent action. And what was really the complaint, and he was getting it from his own people too, was that after each of these violent episodes where Falange members were dying, Jose Antonio wasn't... They wanted him to put the rhetoric and the speeches out there of bold action and violence back to the left. Now, eventually, the Falange started fighting back, and there was killing on both sides going down after that. But even while that was going on, he wasn't beating the drum of violence, which is what was driving Ramos crazy, because he was thinking, we need to, you know, beat the drum of violence. There'll be a lot more of them dying and a lot less of us dying if you just beat the drums of violence in speeches and in rhetoric and you fire people up. And he wouldn't take that. He didn't want to take that position. While he mentioned, you know, he had tough talk, but he wouldn't go as far as to incite it and encourage it. Now, despite his dislike of the, you know, and his ideal of deadly political violence would continue throughout the whole short life of the Falange. We go back to the book. Mathis Montero Rodriguez, a medical student who was one of the principal founders of the SEU, was shot 5 times and killed while returning home from selling copies of the FE, only 20 years of age. So far as it's known, Montero was the first Falangist to die in a planned assassination. Later, under Franco, the anniversary of his murder would become an annual SEU day of commemoration. This succession of unavenged attacks caused certain commenters to suggest FE should stand for Funeral Español, Spanish funeral. Other critics were publishing in their newsletters things like, such a fascism is no more than literature, presenting no risk of adversaries, or a purely theoretical fascism without violence as a tactic may be whatever it pleases, but it's not fascism. So after this ridicule and after the numerous accounts of unanswered violence, Falangist leadership in Madrid began to organize more seriously now for violence. They created a more militant wing used mainly for reactionary violence. They dubbed it the Phalanx of Blood. But even as this creation of this fascist shock troop was going on, fascists were still getting killed in the street. After a 15-year-old Falangist was murdered, the local government decided to prohibit Falangist activities in a number of provinces, and the party's center in Seville was closed altogether. So even though this is your right-wing or conservative slash moderate government, it's the same for America today too, with the right-leaning cucks in government. Even though it's Falange members being killed, because they're inciting the left, they have to shut down the Falange. Instead of doing their job as a government and protecting their citizens from being politically assassinated, instead of doing that, they shut down the victim, essentially. Essentially, they're like, hey, lefties, calm down. We can do what you're trying to achieve legally. We'll just suppress them and shut them down for you, so you don't have to kill them and cause violence. So this is the mentality of the quote-unquote moderate rightist government. It's just no spine at all. So there were even attempts on Jose Antonio's life. Go through a couple of them real fast. On April 10th, 1934, two small bombs that failed to explode were thrown at Jose Antonio's car as he was driving near the center of Madrid, and a series of shots smashed the windshield. The Falangist leader leaped out of his car, accompanied by his two law clerks, and gave chase to the assailants, even exchanging gunshots with them. So, you know, he's no coward. He's not running away from violence. He just wasn't a big fan on promoting it. 2 months later, in June, a second bomb was hurled against his car outside the Model prison, where he had attended a judicial hearing involving a detained Falangist. Yet a third attempt took place subsequently, a late-night attack after a party. On that occasion, confused assailants fired by mistake at the car of noted physician Dr. Luge, who had left the gathering just ahead of Jose Antonio. So, as they create their Phalanx of Blood, their shock troops, the head was Juan Antonio Ansalando, who he was a pilot and won medals for aerial combat in Morocco. So another aviation military star. An 18-year-old Falangist, Juan Sular, son of a police inspector, was killed and his corpse was subsequently mutilated, his head apparently crushed with rocks. One of the Osando squads was quick to respond. Later that evening, as a bus transporting young socialist excursionists unloaded some of them in Madrid, a car full of Falangist pistoleros, personally led by Ansaldo, was waiting. It slowly passed the young people on the sidewalk, spraying them with bullets. A 20-year-old shop clerk, Juanita Rico, was killed. The Falangists claimed she had been involved in desecrating the corpse. Her 21-year-old brother was left permanently disabled and several others wounded. 4 days earlier, a Falangist smallholder had been killed during a farm worker strike. Though numerous leftists had been injured by Falangists in the street affrays and university assaults, Rico was the first leftist fatality at their hands. For years, she would be commemorated as the first victim of fascism in Spain. So if you're keeping score, up until now, it's about 15 or 16 fascists killed to one socialist being killed. So up until this period of time, it was purely one-sided. In the summer of 1934, the centrist government struggled with some desperation to maintain Republican legality in the face of a constitutional challenge in Barcelona and the threatened socialist insurrection, which would finally occur in October. It was not disposed to accept a further challenge from fascists. On the 10th of July, assault guards raided the Falangist Center in Madrid, arresting 67 members of the party, including José Antonio and the Marqués de la Elisieda, its two Cortés deputies, and seizing a variety of weapons and explosives. The two deputies soon had to be released because of their parliamentary immunity. By mid-July, the government had ordered the closing of all Falangist centers throughout the country and prohibited all Falangist publications and public meetings. So that immunity, he got off because he had parliamentary immunity, and that becomes very important in his life, especially at his death, as the leftist government at the time prevented him from running again and getting his parliamentary immunity, which would have kept him out of prison and kept him alive. So his party is getting shut down, membership's not picking up, and among membership there, they're divided over the issue of violence. And once again, the centrist government, they're shut down the fascist, right? Because that's what made sense. Does any of this sound familiar to today, really? I mean, really? You see this coming leftist insurrection, and instead of dealing with that head on, you suppress and control and shut down the people that are the only actual threat to this coming leftist insurrection. And hence why the left is continually attacking them and trying to stamp them out before they ever fully bloom. The writer Heleno Sana, a strong opponent of Falangism, has offered a balanced commentary. José Antonio wanted to convince, not to impose. At the bottom, he was a seducer, not a dictator. He believed in the dialectic of fist and pistols as a last resort. Before organizing its own repressive squads, the Falange was the victim of physical reprisals by the extreme left. The violent squads of the Falange were finally accepted by José Antonio as a purely practical necessity, but not out of inner conviction. So even as his opponents, even the rational people who are looking at it balanced, acknowledge that the violence of the Falange was reactionary violence, as it typically is with fascism. Fascism being a reactionary force. So his first year did not go too well. They were getting murdered by the left, harassed by the right, and momentarily paralyzed by the centrist government. But all the government bannings and restrictions were temporary. So in a short matter of time, the Falange was a functioning party again, but still a party with very little support and momentum, and the inner conflict continued. The tension between José Antonio on the one hand and the rightist and more extremist sectors of the party on the other neared the boiling point. The latter were led by Ansaldo, the shock troop leader. Their complaint was that Jose Antonio was too moderate and failed to encourage direct action, meaning violence. Ansaldo's plan was to collect a dozen or so of his commando leaders and burst into Jose Antonio, deposing him by force, dissolving the executive triumvirate and replacing it with a new configuration in which the more militant Ruiz de Alda would be the head of the party and Ramos general secretary. As soon as Jose Antonio got first word of this, he ordered Ansaldo to appear before a meeting of the triumvirate. Ansaldo did not deny his position or his plan, and Jose Antonio had him expelled from the party forthwith. Ruiz de Alda was against this, and so to a lesser degree was Ramos, but Jose Antonio threatened either to split the party completely or abandon it, and quickly got his way. On 29 August, the sculptor, Joaquin Delgado, a member of the Communist Party Central Committee, was killed in a street clash with Falangists. 2 weeks later, the local leader of the Falange in San Sebastian was slain, and in revenge, Falangist gunmen struck down the vacationing Manuel Andres Casas, a former national police. Both Ramos and Ruiz de Alda continued to press for a policy that was more aggressive and, they hoped, more demagogic and revolutionary. Ramos was well aware of Ruiz de Alda's annoyance at the expulsion of his old friend Ansaldo, and therefore suggested that the time had come to get rid of Jose Antonio, or at least force him to take a back seat, thus freeing the Falange from the restraint of his rather liberal temperament. Ruiz de Alda was tempted but hesitated to break from Jose Antonio, simply in order to build a partnership with the tough-minded Ramos. Soon after this, the triumvirate would dissolve. Unfortunately, like the first triumvirate and the second triumvirate of Rome, the triumvirate of the Falange would also fall apart. Thankfully, unlike the first and second triumvirate, civil war would not break out between the members of the triumvirate. They would just go their own way. So it would devolve, and thanks to the supporters of Jose Antonio, Jose Antonio would become the effective leader of the Falange. Ramos would leave the party, and encouraging the rebirth of his former group. 2 years later, in 1936, Ramos would be imprisoned by the Popular Front government, the leftist government, and at the outbreak of the Civil War, he'd be murdered by a firing squad. In fact, the same fate would befall Ruiz de Alda as well, as he too was murdered by a government firing squad in 1936. And, just to top it all three members of the triumvirate would be shot to death in 1936 by leftist government firing squads. So, this essentially was the death of the Falange. Sure, it existed long after 1936, but mainly as a Frankenstein creation, with Dr. Franco creating it, using the symbols and the catchphrases and the sacrifices of the Falange as a vehicle for him to gain trust and power and unity in the different fractioning sides of the right.
La Falange was in trouble. Jose Antonio had been killed in a Republican jail. All other potential candidates were in prison or dead, and the organization was riven with ideological and personal schism. On April 17, 1937, a former mechanic, Manuel Edia, was confirmed as leader. He had no formal education, was unimaginative and ineffective. He was easy meat for Franco. 2 days after his election, Franco, as head of state, declared the Falange and the Carlists would be unified in one national movement under his own direction. When Edia challenged Franco's authority, he was sentenced to death, although this sentence was commuted to life imprisonment. By bringing the red-berried Carlist and the blue-shirted Falange movement under his direct leadership, Franco assured the triumph of his personal brand of authoritarian conservatism and the unity of his supporters. The man who claimed to support the restoration of the monarchy had made himself a dictator. True supporters of the king, like Eugenio Vegas La Tapia, were outraged.
Pues el nuevo estado que había creado Franco, It seemed as if the new state created by Franco wasn't so much a state as a dictatorship. A dictatorship run exclusively by him. Don Pedro Sainz Rodriguez says with some accuracy that the difference between laws and decrees in Franco's regime was that Franco pulled decrees out of one pocket and laws from the other. Everything was the exclusive wish of the Generalissimo.
Franco's regime was a conservative dictatorship, but it was cloaked in symbols and ritual of fascism. In the European economic depression of the 30s, fascism could be seen, and was seen, by many as an up-to-date alternative to the politics of class struggle, to unite a nation, even forcibly, in one supposed common interest, was a superficially attractive doctrine. At least it provided Franco, the reactionary soldier, with a facade of modern political ideology. Franco saw his task as blending the conflicting elements of the new Spain while maintaining the traditional values of the old. The charismatic fascist leader José Antonio Primo de Rivera was gone, shot in a Republican jail. Franco assumed his mantle.
One could say Franco misrepresented José Antonio. He emphasized the inoffensive side, at least what was inoffensive to conservative people, and he silenced and buried anything that threatened them.
José Antonio had argued for the revolutionary upheaval of Spain's old order, but now he was dead. His name was carved in the stomach of Burgos Cathedral. Every church in Spain carried this potent legend. Thus the Falange Revolution became absorbed within the symbolism of Spain's deepest reaction, the Church. And Franco presided.
España! España!
Libre!
José Antonio Primo Rivera! Arriba España!
José Antonio's memory was preserved, but the radical aspirations of his brand of fascism were laid to rest.
What José Antonio had predicted before the war came true. He had said that the Falange could contribute, without knowing it, to the restoration of a conservative bourgeois mediocrity of which, he commented, there is such a generous sample in Spain, and it would be adorned to add to the mockery with the choreographic figures of the blue shirts.
Se puso una careta de situación francamente fascista, como se decía entonces.
The regime presented a mask which was basically fascist, but deep down this wasn't the case. I would describe it as an economically conservative, authoritarian government because order had to be imposed, but with a facade and certain details from totalitarian regimes to be found elsewhere in Europe.
Like many Europeans during the 1920s and 30s, José Antonio was heavily influenced by Oswald Spengler's concept of history of civilizations and of their historical rise and fall. Like Spengler himself, however, José Antonio rejected the mere resignation to historical and cultural processes, which he believed could be fundamentally altered by the political and cultural will. I think this is where you see a difference between traditionalist and fascist in that sense, where traditionalists seem to put more emphasis on the age itself, while the fascist, and like he's saying, influenced José Antonio, influenced by Spengler, believe human will can change the era, the time, the age. Like all fascist movements, the Falange proclaimed itself neither of the right nor the left. Though, like the left, it was opposed to capitalism and the bourgeoisie. The capitalism to which it was opposed was not simply private property, which was to be respected, but impersonal and transnational big business and monopolies, which should in various ways be controlled. The bourgeoisie, to which the movement was opposed, were not ordinary owners of private property, but those who represented materialism, skepticism, and self-indulgence, and a style of life based on compromise and opposition to self-sacrifice. During its first full year, the Falangist organization had taken clear form. Members were divided between militants and adherents, the former being full active members and the latter less involved but willing to participate in accessory activities such as distributing information. A tiny woman section had been started by Jose Antonio's younger sister, Pilar, and several of her friends in June 1934. Membership increased modestly during 1935, but remained insignificant compared with the major parties. It is thought that during their last year of actual existence in 1936, that they had around 10,000 members, and in a country with around 25 million at the time. The right-center coalition that governed Spain during 1935 sought to discourage extremism and kept the Falange on a short leash. Its publications, like those on the left extremist groups, were constantly censored and frequently fined. Entire editions were sometimes confiscated. Provincial centers might be closed after any outbursts of violence, sometimes in the case of very modern incidents. And authorization for meetings was sometimes withheld until the last minute, and occasionally denied altogether. And of course, through 1935, the violence continued. In a reoccurrent cycle of violence, Falangists killed the president of the Casa del Pueblo and two other socialists on 8 April 1935. 3 weeks later, on 29 April, a Falangist and an adversary was killed in a street battle. Later, on the 6th of November, two Falangists, a student and a mechanic, were killed in Seville while posting propaganda. Jose Antonio drew attention to this popular incident, claiming that it was only one in a series of attacks on the Falangists in that region, and that, in his words, the Falange is proud that not even once has it initiated an aggression. The Falange can say that not even once has an aggression been proven. We jump forward now to the 1936 election, and this was the election that would give the left the majority control of the government, which in turn later would kick off the Spanish Civil War, as the rightist and the military would rebel against the communists, the liberals, and the anarchists. The electoral outcome was a disaster for the Falange, which garnered only 44,000 votes in all Spain, or about 0.7 of the popular vote. So the party was still in its infancy, around for 3 years, getting 0.7% of the popular vote. Of course, a lot of the votes went towards the centrist right-wing government, which lost to the left in this election. But it puts things into perspective. Even with 44,000 votes, that's still 0.7% of the popular vote. After the election, a local chief Falangist in Seville wrote, "After the February elections, I had absolute faith in the triumph of the Falange, because we could now consider the right, our most difficult enemy, defeated and eliminated. Their failure provided us with a great advantage, as well as the inheritance of a greater part of their best youth." So the fascists are looking at the silver lining in the cloud, as the centrists and the moderates had failed, and they thought their way can contain the left just a few years earlier. But now the reality dawned on them. No, it couldn't. And so the Falangists wanted to take advantage of this to get the support, especially of the youth, saying, look, these moderates, it's not going to work. With the leftist government, the Popular Front, in power, the crackdown on the Falange not only continued but intensified. On February 26th, the newly rented Falangist center was raided by police during a meeting. On the following day, the center was officially closed by the authorities on the charge of illicit possessions of firearms. The last number of Arriba, a fascist newsletter, appeared on March 5th. So they're raiding their meetings, they're shutting down their newspapers. Violence continued in the streets with the Falangists, as usual, not being the aggressor, but nevertheless, in a month's period, about six Falangists were murdered and about two communists. But what really got the government in an uproar was the assassination attempt by a Falange member on a prominent socialist leader and law professor. Shortly after the assassination attempt, the leftist government went into action arresting and detaining the Falangist leadership. On the night of the 13th, orders were given for the arrest of the national leaders of the Falange and the SEU. The arrest of José Antonio simply read, "Arrested as a fascist." The official justification for the arrest was that the party leaders had violated the order of February 27th that had closed the Falange Center because the official seal of the closure placed on the front door had been broken. Now, what kind of manipulative bullshit is that? So they put a seal on the door of their headquarters, and because that seal was broken, obviously the Falangist had broken in there and violated the law, and José Antonio must be arrested for this. So this is the kind of kangaroo court shit that was going on when the left was looking to persecute their enemies. But even as José Antonio was incarcerated, the violence still continued. A leftist judge was shot to death on the streets. 3 days later, a first cousin of José Antonio was one of 6 people killed and 32 wounded in a running battle in the streets after another Falangist was killed by socialists. A special Falangist commando squad dragged the president and several other members from the local Casa del Pueblo and lynched them on a public street. By June 1st, the party's death toll since its founding had reached 70. So the couple years it's been around, already 70 of its members had been killed. The civil war would break out when rightist and right-leaning generals would stage a coup against the government. By the time the civil war began, approximately 2,000 party members were in prison, so that the maintenance of the party's administrative system became increasingly difficult. The state kept figuring ways to keep José Antonio in jail. First, they charged him with insults and lack of respect for authority, because he had made a joke about a guard while he was incarcerated. So this was a charge brought up against him and as a reason to keep him in prison longer. Then they charged him with illegal association. Then when it looked like he was going to be released, because all these charges were very small in penalty and he just kept getting like 2 month sentence, 2 month sentence, 2 month sentence, they figured out another way to keep him in prison. We'll go back to the book. To prevent his imminent release, the authorities quickly introduced a new indictment, this time for illegal possession of firearms. 3 days earlier, the police had conducted a thorough search of José Antonio's home, allegedly finding 3 loaded pistols. As the object of 3 early assassination attempts, the Falangist chief had long possessed a license to own weapons. But on March 10th, the new government had abruptly canceled all existing permits, allowing a grace period of 15 days for their renewal. Just a way to get everyone on their rosters who has a gun. José Antonio had been arrested 4 days earlier and had little time to renew his permits. So, once again, just the slyness of manipulating the laws and the system. They give everyone 15 days to renew their guns. They arrest José Antonio 4 days into this 15-day period. And since he was in jail while after the period passed, now they can charge him. Now his guns become illegal and they can charge him for them. The court heard the case on the 28th of May and sentenced José Antonio to another 5 months. José Antonio flew into a towering rage and shouted abuses at the judges while he dramatically tore part of his toga and threw his lawyer's cap, because he was representing himself, on the floor, stamping on it and refusing to sign the judicial record. Yeah, so of course he's pissed because he's bringing that up. It's like, you arrest me 4 days into this 15-day period and now you're going to charge me because my guns aren't registered? It's like, well, you arrested me on some stupid shit and then make sure I stay in jail long enough and then charge me with this. So of course he flew into a rage. When the court secretary observed, "A ruffian like his father," or words to that effect, José Antonio struck him on the head and threw him to the ground. The outburst then led to 2 further indictments, one for contempt of court and another for offense against authority. So now they're just piling up more charges on him. They got him. They got him in there and they're not going to let him out. The government clearly had no intention of releasing José Antonio, for whom the lack of parliamentary immunity now constituted the gravest of handicaps. Now, remember, years ago, he had got caught. Well, they had been busted in a room with guns, and he was able to get out of that because of his immunity. So José Antonio's last hope was to win back his government immunity by winning a seat in government. Even though behind bars, his name was put on the ballot for a special election in 1936. Despite being incarcerated and not being able to campaign for himself, he still won the seat in his local district. The government then stepped in and simply said he is not valid to run for office and tossed out all of his votes. Primo de Rivera was deprived of a seat that he had won in popular votes after the governor announced that his votes simply would not be counted. So, once again, if you don't break the law, they'll break the law to get you. And they just simply threw out all his votes because this would have saved him. This would have let him out of prison that moment. He would have been saved. He would have lived beyond at least the moment he was killed. José Antonio's only hope for survival now was to be broken out of prison. But he did not hold much hope in the rightist generals. As he said, it is useless to count on the generals on active duty. They are chickens, and Franco is the biggest chicken of all. And I think Franco got that reputation because he kind of hesitated in the Civil War. And people looked at it as he was weighing his options. He was more of an opportunist. Franco was more of an opportunist than anything else. Opportunist, conservative, right-leaning, but opportunist. Not a fascist. People often confuse him for a fascist, but he was not a fascist at all. In fact, it'd be to his benefit that José Antonio died, which was another criticism of him, that he didn't send enough serious battalions to break him out of prison. Franco made some wise moves during the Civil War that's got him popularity. One time saving pinned down rightists in an abandoned building, and they were pinned by gunfire, and he rolled into town and saved them, and that became a legend. And things like this just helped promote his name. But he didn't get to José Antonio. Even though people did try, it was nothing, a mass number of people or enough people are serious enough to actually get into the prison and free José Antonio. So with the outbreak of civil war and at least 2,000 Falangists, either custody of the state within Popular Front controlled zones, many of them were murdered immediately. José Antonio would now go before the court for the last time, this time with his life in his hands of this crooked court. He was charged with military rebellion. Mind you, he's been in jail this whole time. As Civil War breaks out, all this stuff. He was in jail, and he's charged with military rebellion now. The court then sentenced José Antonio to death and decreed life imprisonment for his brother. The execution took place within the Alicante prison early in the morning of 20th November. José Antonio was shot by a firing squad with four other political prisoners. There was no formal burial. The corpses were simply thrown into a common grave, to be followed by the cadavers of 10 other victims of political executions later that same day. His last words spoken in public were, I believe this was to a journalist, "You will see now that no ideological gulfs separate us. If we men knew one another, we should realize that these gulfs we think we see are nothing but little valleys." And this is his realization that all this division, all this fighting we're doing, could be said the same for today. All this division, we think there's this wide variety of things that separate us, when it's really not. It's really these little things that all can be worked out. Thus would mark the official death of the Falange. All three members of the original triumvirate murdered in the same year ended the short life of the Falange from 1933 to 1936. So thus is the life of José Antonio Primo de Rivera and the Falange. He was a poetic and romantic man who gave speeches that touched on the passions and the ideals of a greater tomorrow and a greater future for Spain. He truly sought after unity, even much to his own detriment. He truly wanted to avoid killing his own brothers, his own fellow citizens, his own fellow Spaniards over political ideology. He detested that they even had this big disagreement amongst each other, amongst these stupid political parties, when he thought what mattered was the patria, was the nation, was the people, and that unity could be reached through common understanding and the common good. Unfortunately, as often the story ends with these young revolutionaries, he met his death in an untimely manner, dying for his beliefs. While he, just like people like Kadrianu, time on this earth was cut way too short, his memory and the memory of people like him live on forever because of their dedication, their sacrifice, and their martyrdom. Suggested readings for this video, once again, The Spanish Answer, passages from the spoken and written message of José Antonio Primo de Rivera, and Fascism in Spain, 1923 to 1977, by Stanley G. Payne.